You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. The president just finished his speech to the National Defense University. National Defense University, where people go to learn to be soldiers, I believe. Here at Fort McNair, he said, Americans have served in uniform since 1791. That would have been the third year of the George Washington administration, if I recall correctly. 1789, 90, 91, maybe the second, third year. I'm not sure exactly what the date was that Washington was sworn in and the United States officially rebooted itself after the Articles of Confederation. But in any case, he gave the speech, and I think this is absolutely brilliant. First of all, this of course is going to be the Fox News talking point. There's going to be two big. Let me tell you what the two big Fox News talking points are, and then we can talk about what really is going on here and what's important. The first big Fox talking point is going to be, he has changed the conversation because he was under siege, and so nobody's paying attention to Daryl Issa anymore. So let's cut back to Daryl Issa and see what he has to say about this. Daryl, do you think that he got the American people to stop listening to you going after him with Benghazi and IRS and everything? That's how it's going to play on Fox News. You're going to see, commentator after commentator all night long saying, oh, he just, he was trying to change the conversation. Well, I don't doubt that he was trying to change the conversation, but this was a speech of some consequence if it is followed through by action, and I believe it will be. I mean, he's calling out the Republicans here in this speech. First, he calls out, almost to the point of ridicule, George W. Bush and his response to 9/11. Early on in the speech, he says, what is clear is that, I'll just read it. It's okay, Shane. You don't have to find it. It is clear that we quickly drove al-Qaeda out of Afghanistan, but then shifted our focus and began a new war in Iraq. This carried grave consequences for our fight against al-Qaeda, our standing in the world, and to this day, our interests in a vital region. In other words, Bush starting the war in Iraq screwed the United States. And then he goes through everything that we've done to try to deal with this massive blunder. It's amazing. This morning I was walking into the studio, and there was a bunch of monitors on, and one of them was on Fox, and they were interviewing Don Rumsfeld. And I thought, only on Fox, right? Do they recycle the Bush administration people? And what credibility does this man have? And the president of the United States today is saying basically, this is not good. He says, and in some cases, I believe we compromised our basic values by using torture to interrogate our enemies and detaining individuals in a way that ran counter to the rule of law. In other words, he says the Bush administration broke the law. He started out with that. Anyhow, a little later, he goes through, who we are and what we're all about, and basically what he's saying. He quoted James Madison at one point, and it's a quote that I've used in a number of back in the 2002, 3, 4, 5 era during the early Bush years when I was writing real, real regularly for CommonDreams.org. I frequently, and actually in my book, We the People, the cartoon book, cartoon is the wrong word, the illustrated book, I've got that quote from James Madison. No country can maintain its, this is not the exact words, but no country can maintain its democracy in the presence of a perpetual war. In fact, Madison went even beyond that. He talked about how during times of war, the president has all these additional powers and it can be very seductive, and we've got to be very careful about that. He threw Tim McVeigh in. He says, finally, we face a real threat from radicalized individuals here in the United States. Whether it is a shooter at a Sikh temple in Wisconsin, right-wing militia guy, a plane flying into a building in Texas, well, that would be Joe Stack, or the extremists who killed 168 people at the federal building in Oklahoma City, that would be Tim McVeigh, America has confronted many forms of violent extremism in our time. That was interesting. But perhaps one of the most fascinating parts of the whole thing was he was interrupted twice. And I think I know who interrupted him. Her voice sounded quite familiar, although the cameras didn't go to her, so I'm not going to make an identification unless somebody else has already who was there. And she interrupted him once, and he said, you know, let me finish. I'm going to say what you want to hear. And then he proceeded to say it. You have that, Shane? Here it is.
How about Abdul-Rahman?
This is the second interruption, actually. And at this point, this being the second interruption, at this point, he's letting her finish, but they're taking her out of the room. The first time,
we're addressing that, ma'am.
They didn't actually take her out of the room. Drones are making us less safe, and compensate the victims, and what about the 16-year-old kid? And
you know, I think that the...
And here he goes off script.
And I'm going off script, as you might expect here. the voice of that woman is worth paying attention to.
Wow.
Obviously.
Now he's got to distance himself from her.
Obviously, I do not agree.
Savage him
with much of what she said.
I don't agree.
And obviously, she wasn't listening to me in much of what I said. But these are tough issues, and the suggestion that we can gloss over them,
as the Bush administration did.
You know, when that judge sentenced Mr. Reed, the shoe bomber. He went on to point to the American flag that flew in the courtroom. That flag, he said, will fly there long after this is all forgotten. That flag still stands for freedom. So, America, we face down dangers far greater than Al-Qaeda.
So now he's back on script. But I thought that was a remarkable moment. And he's saying throughout this speech, basically, you know, Bush panicked. Bush did awful things. The country went in the wrong direction. We've ended that war in Iraq, arguably. We're not torturing people anymore. He wants to close down Guantanamo. He called out Congress. He said the only reason that Guantanamo is not closed, I'm paraphrasing here, is because of politics. It was really a remarkable speech. We'll be right back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
More of the president's speech and his change in direction after this. Welcome back to the place where we dare to ask, is Walmart a person? And we dare to say no. I would submit to you that what President Obama just said, and I'm trying to do this in as non-cheerleading a fashion as possible, because I still have a certain, you know, I A, even if he's like totally solid on all his stuff, and I think he probably is, he's got to deal with the Republicans in Congress. But that's and he's got to deal with Fox News, and he's got to do the obligatory tip to the hard right and all that other nonsense. But basically, the carry-home message of this speech was the era of George Bush is over. We did this stupid diversion, whatever, into Iraq. It was unnecessary. It hurt us in terms of money, in terms of blood, in terms of standing in the world. We're not doing that anymore. We're not going to have a foreign policy that's run by fear. Instead, it's going to be run by wisdom. He actually used that word. Those words, fear and wisdom. And he actually called for the authorization to use military force, the AUMF, or AUMF, or what, AUMF, to be repealed. Do you have the clip that starts with the AUMF is now 12 years old, nearly 12 years old? Okay. When you found it, let me know, because I'd like to play that. Because he's basically saying, okay, enough. In another spot, he said, you know, this war, like every war, has to end. He's echoing James Madison. I mean, it's amazing when you consider, here we are 12 years out, the incredible damage that George Bush did by the way that he chose to respond to an act, a criminal act, as if we had been, you know, as if Japan had bombed Pearl Harbor. Here's the president on this.
And that is why I intend to engage Congress about the existing authorization to use military force, or AUMF, to determine how we can continue to fight terrorism without keeping America on a perpetual wartime footing. The AUMF is now nearly 12 years old. The Afghan war is coming to an end. Core Al-Qaeda is a shell of its former self. Groups like AQAP must be dealt with, but in the years to come, not every collection of thugs that labels themselves Al-Qaeda will pose a credible threat to the United States. Unless we discipline our thinking, our definitions, our actions, we may be drawn into more wars we don't need to fight, or continue to grant presidents unbound powers more suited for traditional armed conflicts between nation states. So I look forward to engaging Congress and the American people in efforts to refine and ultimately repeal the AUMF's mandate. And I will not sign laws designed to expand this mandate further. Our systematic effort to dismantle terrorist organizations must continue. But this war, like all wars, must end. That's what history advises. That's what our democracy demands.
And then from there, he says, in fact, the next sentence, and that brings me to my final topic, the detention of terrorist suspects. And he gets into, you know, it's time to close Guantanamo. And he points out, he says, you know, the original premise for opening Gitmo, that detainees would not be able to challenge their detention, was found unconstitutional 5 years ago, the president said today. So Gitmo is unconstitutional. The Supreme Court ruled that 5 years ago. Our allies won't cooperate with us if they think a terrorist will end up at Gitmo. During a time of budget cuts, we spend $150 million each year to imprison 166 people, almost $1 million a prisoner. I mean, it's quite extraordinary. So here is, he says, this is the given my administration's relentless pursuit. Do you have that, Shane? It's where he says no justification beyond politics.
Related offenses, including some folks who are more dangerous than most Gitmo detainees.
There we go. Just listen for a minute.
They're in our prisons. And given my administration's relentless pursuit of Al-Qaeda's leadership, there is no justification beyond politics for Congress to prevent us from closing a facility that should have never been opened.
And he said today, why once again calling Congress to lift the restrictions on detainee transfers from Gitmo. Never should have been opened. It's unconstitutional. There is no justification beyond politics for Congress to prevent us from closing a facility that never should have been opened. I mean, this is the guy. You would not hear this kind of rhetoric from Mitt Romney. There is, we can do the circular firing squad and complain about how, you know, the Democrats, Republicans, they're all, you know, corporate this or that, whatever. But this is not the speech that Mitt Romney would be giving. This is not the speech that George W. Bush would be giving. They would want more war, more detention, more unconstitutional actions. This is a constitutional scholar saying enough. James Madison was right. No nation can preserve its freedom in the midst of perpetual warfare. This war has to end. The authorization that was given to George Bush for the use of force was beyond the pale, basically. It's time for that to come to an end. I think this speech is a BFD. I think it's a big deal. And I genuinely hope that it does knock all this petty scandals gate nonsense off the front pages and cause us to have a serious discussion as a nation. This is our standing in the world. This is our future. 27 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
So your thoughts on President Obama's speech, and more of mine afterwards.
We have to be mindful of James Madison's warning that no nation could preserve its freedom in the midst of continual warfare.
So it's time to end the war. It's time to say enough. It was a mistake. The war in Iraq was a mistake. Well, he's not going to say the war in Afghanistan was a mistake. I'll say that. All this war stuff was a mistake. A crime was committed against the United States, and Afghanistan offered to help us arrest and try the perpetrator. Prosecute the perpetrator. That's the right phrase there. And George Bush said, no, don't arrest Osama bin Laden. I'll come and get him. I'll drop bombs on your people. This is a country. Afghanistan was a country that at the time that George Bush invaded it had a gross domestic product. The average income was about $300 a year. And that's for the people who are working. And they had a gross domestic product of $2 billion. The entire country, all year, $2 billion. We were spending $2 billion every half day in Afghanistan. There was one point where he was talking, where the president was talking about foreign aid. This is on page 8, Shane, of the transcript. But foreign assistance cannot be viewed as charity. Can you dig that clip out, or shall I just read that on the air? It's the very top of page 8. Got it? Okay. Here, let's see if we can hear it. Listen to this. This is remarkable.
And we must help countries modernize economies, upgrade education, and encourage entrepreneurship. Because American leadership has always been elevated by our ability to connect with people's hopes and not simply their fears. And success on all these fronts requires sustained engagement, but it will also require resources. I know that foreign aid is one of the least popular expenditures that there is. That's true for Democrats and Republicans. I've seen the polling. Even though it amounts to less than 1% of the federal budget. In fact, a lot of folks think it's 25% if you ask people on the streets. Less than 1%. Still wildly unpopular. But foreign assistance cannot be viewed as charity. It is fundamental to our national security. And it's fundamental to any sensible long-term strategy to battle extremism. Moreover, foreign assistance is a tiny fraction of what we spend fighting wars that our assistance might ultimately prevent.
That our assistance might prevent.
For what we spent in a month in Iraq at the height of the war, we could be training security forces in Libya, maintaining peace agreements between Israel and its neighbors, feeding the hungry in Yemen, building schools in Pakistan, and creating reservoirs of goodwill that marginalize extremists.
There you go. I mean, for what we spent in a month in Iraq, in Bush's war, Bush's unnecessary, stupid, deadly war, for what we spent in a month in Iraq, we could be training security forces in Libya, maintaining peace agreements between Israel and its neighbors, feeding the hungry in Yemen, building schools in Pakistan, and creating reservoirs of goodwill that marginalize extremists. It's incredible. Tim, in Encinitas, California, you want to disagree with me, so we'll put you at the front of the list. You think this is just more of the, you know, Obama gives a good speech?
Absolutely, Tom. I think the Associated Press incident is incredible. And then he goes and says, yes, we should have this law that my buddy said we should have last year. But, you know, if you really thought that, why did you do that to the Associated Press? And, you know, there's a lot of this double talking all the time, you know, just raining murder from heaven and then saying, well, we couldn't get boots on the ground. Maybe you shouldn't have boots on the ground. Maybe you really didn't know who you were murdering from heaven.
Yeah.
And this is being God, and it's very disturbing to me.
Yeah, it's very disturbing to me too, Tim, and that's why I'm pleased that since 2009, every year, Obama's been doing less and less of this. I don't think he should be doing any of it, but he's been doing less and less of it. He continues to think that it's justified. He pointed out that he has notified Congress of every single one of these drone strikes, if you're talking about the drone strikes. For the record, and many, many times, have said I think that we're doing more harm than good with these things. I think that's sinking into this administration. I see forward motion here. And he also said, you know, he's going to bring in the press. He's going to put together an advisory board. They're going to come up with some sort of a media shield law that's perhaps better than what Chuck Schumer is introducing, because that's got that national security exemption in it, which, in my opinion, turns it into a weak shell of itself. We'll see if there's a reality here. This is just happy words, but frankly, you're not going to get to reality if you don't. And Tim, thank you for the call. You're not going to get to reality if you don't start with happy words. So we'll see. Don in Seattle. Hey, Don. Thanks for watching Free Speech TV. What's up?
Hi, Tom. How you doing?
Good.
Anyway, this whole thing reminds me, of course, another famous Republican president speech, the military-industrial complex speech by Eisenhower.
Yeah.
And it seems to me that we're just like in another Vietnam quagmire, and he warned about the dangers of abuse of governmental power because of the military-industrial complex. And, you know, the defense contractors and all the people profiteering off of this war. Is there a way, Tom, do you think that they could possibly profit off of peacetime? You know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, actually, there is. And it would be through foreign policy, through foreign aid. And although I doubt that, you know, anybody's ever going to make the kind of money on foreign aid that they make on war. So actually, probably no. You're right, Don. You make a very good point. And that's the problem, is you've got this giant military-industrial lobby here in Washington, D.C. Paul in South Lyon, Michigan. Hey, Paul, what's up?
Yeah, how you doing, Tom?
Hey. Well,
for my point, I want to point out that, you know, the Obama ended the Iraq war, and he's in the process of ending the war in Afghanistan.
Right. My point earlier, anyway, this is not George Bush, and this is not Mitt Romney. There is a difference.
Yeah. Right, right. But anyway, I want to say that, you know, I'm a proud progressive, and I'm probably more progressive than Code Pink, Michael Hastings, and Glenn Greenwald put together on social and economic issues. But I live in the Detroit area, and my girlfriend flies on business at least twice a week. Now, the underwear bomber was trying to blow up a plane over Detroit. So, I mean, it's quite possible that President Obama saved my life by going after Al-Awlaki, who was up to his neck in all those plots, to kill innocent Americans. And I don't like hearing my fellow progressives criticize President Obama for saving our lives. You know, I mean, he did what he had to do. That guy was trying to kill Americans.
I would have been much more comfortable, Paul, with him taking out al-Awlaki if he had a trial first, even if it was in absentia, even if it was a relatively secret trial like a grand jury proceeding, if there was some sort of due process. I don't think that now, you know, Obama's justification is we're at war and you don't have trials at war before you shoot at the enemy. You just shoot at the enemy. That's what a war is all about. And I personally, I reject that. I think that what we are facing is a bunch of criminals. And we have been from the very beginning, and by treating them as if they were warriors, as if they were state actors, we have elevated them. We have given them more credibility. Frankly, I think that if Bush hadn't reacted the way that he did to 9/11, if we hadn't invaded Afghanistan and Pakistan, al-Awlaki never would have happened. And in fact, he was fairly clear in his statements, this American, that he had been radicalized by Bush's behavior in Iraq and Afghanistan. So, you know, we've got there's both pieces of this thing. And you know, maybe what Obama did by taking out al-Awlaki was a good thing in as much as, you know, it stopped, you know, a plane from going down in Detroit and saved your life or your girlfriend's, as the case may be. But when you look at, and there's a great op-ed in today's New York Times, on the front page of the New York Times, where it just goes through this list of these children, basically young people in Pakistan who were killed by drones and, you know, who were absolutely innocent, had nothing to do with anything. And they have never been acknowledged. They've never been apologized to. They have never been, gotten any kind of compensation. And that's how you breed terrorism. So I think that in, you know, net, our drone program has done more harm than good. But, you know, on the other hand, what Obama is saying is that he's going to try and recalibrate it, make it very, very tight, make it very narrow. He wants to come up with rules of engagement. I think that he's thinking in terms of, you know, the next administration might be a Republican. The next administration might be, you know, a bunch of neocons, a bunch of warmongers. And how do we put into place right now, and he's calling on Congress to help do this, how do we put into place right now some substantial restrictions on presidential power so that, you know, the next president doesn't go off and do like George Bush did and commit crimes and torture people and do crazy drones. Apparently, George Bush killed three Americans before with drones before Obama came into office. So I think the total number now is seven. So, you know, I see this as an appropriate step. Paul, thank you for the call. And thanks for your comments. Maybe I have stars in my eyes. I genuinely don't think so. You look at the history of this country, and the rhetoric always preceded the action. Somebody's got to talk this stuff up. Let's close Guantanamo. Let's go back to our values before it starts happening.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And not having the ability to overcome a filibuster in the Senate, and not having the House, all the president has is the bully pulpit. He used it well today, in my opinion. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Mandy, listening on KBCS in Seattle. Hey, Mandy, what's on your mind? Mandy?
Uh-oh.
Hey, you're on the air.
Oh, hi, Tom.
Yes.
Oh, sorry, I'm driving in a tunnel. Am I on?
You are.
I'm coming out of a tunnel. I am really happy to hear your comments as the first reaction because I share your opinion. I thought it was a remarkable speech, very comprehensive, and just covered everything I wanted him to cover. And I know there's going to be a lot of cynical responses, and I'm sure my friend Mike Papantoni will have some. But I agree with you. I thought it was just brilliant. But my only reserve is I think the president mentioned at one point that we will defeat al-Qaeda, and I think that's almost Bush-like.
Yeah.
And that we'll never defeat the fundamentalism, the extremism. So I wished he hadn't gone there, but yeah. Other than that, I
think that's the kind of stuff you've got to say in order to, you know, in order to mollify the people who watch Fox News who think that they're independents. There's, you know, it's just there's this certain obligatory, you know, the whole God bless America thing. I mean, there's this is obligatory stuff that presidents have to do, or politicians have to do, shall we say, that, you know, I agree with you. You know, yeah, we're not going to defeat Al Qaeda. What's going to happen is Al Qaeda is going to, you know, stumble along and they're going to get stronger or weaker or whatever. And we'll see. Although, if you look back at the history of Europe, where they treated in Italy the Red Brigades, no, that was Germany was the Red Brigades, wasn't it? Italy was the, no, yeah, Germany was the Bader-Meinhof Brigade, Italy was the Red Brigades, Ireland, it was the Irish Republican Army, the IRA, in Spain, it was the Basque Liberation Front, I think, no, there was a different name for the Basque separatists, but whatever it was, ETA, E-T-A. Which meant something in their language, and each one of these groups have now, you know, either vanished or, in the case of the Basque Liberationists, the Irish Republican Army have renounced violence, and because they were dealt with as criminals rather than as, you know, foreign armies that have to be unilaterally brought to their knees and ultimately totally wiped out and defeated or killed off. You know, and Obama acknowledged that to a certain extent. He said there will be no ceremony on a battleship. There will be no tearing down of a statue. Another side-handed swipe at George Bush, and you know, to mark the end of this war. He said you're not going to have that, but it will end. And so I think that that's a good point. Mandy, thank you for the call. Thanks for your kind words. Ron in Long Island. Hey, Ron. Thanks for listening to WWRL. What's up?
Hey, buddy. How come Obama didn't close Gitmo when he first came into office?
Because the Republicans passed a law in Congress
He had the House and the Senate, didn't he?
No, he had the Senate for 11 weeks.
He had the House too.
Yeah, he had the House. He had the Senate for 11 weeks
when he first came into office, and I think it was like 2 days after his inauguration.
He had the Senate for 11. Weeks, and then Scott Brown was sworn in, and Mitch McConnell started filibustering everything, including legislation to close Guantanamo Bay.
Close it in that 11 weeks?
He didn't succeed in doing it in those 11 weeks, and perhaps if you look back, you could say that that was a terrible failure. But you know, yeah, he did try. Yeah, Nancy Pelosi, they passed legislation out of the House of Representatives to close Guantanamo, and it went to the Senate, and all the Democrats voted for it, more than half, which is what the Constitution calls for.
They could have brought it to the floor that day and wrote it on it, but nobody did.
No, sometimes it takes more than 11 weeks to write a law, particularly something as complex as closing something that is illegal.
But he's doing it with an executive order?
Ron, no, he couldn't. It had to be funded by Congress. You can't move hundreds, 300-400 people into prisons in the United States without some funding. Ron, you know, your Republican talking points, your let's try, and in fact, your attempt to reach out to the cynical progressive base is frankly pathetic. I don't know how to describe it beyond that. It's pathetic. Oh, I don't know about you. As he pointed out in a speech, Congress actually passed legislation making it impossible for him to close Guantanamo, and he said today it's only for politics. And when guys like you, Ron, call this program, and I'm sure you're calling all of them, right? And I don't know what they're paying you to do it, or if you really believe this stuff. If you just think, you know, Obama's some kind of evil, awful socialist, or oh my God, a black guy in the White House, or whatever your motivation is. I think it's just tragic that we can't have a rational dialogue in this country, and that, well, I'm starting to get redundant. I'll stop at that point. Danette in Hinesville, Georgia. Hey, Danette, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Well, first of all, I wanted to thank you for guiding me to call Senator Sanders about the mortgage issue that I was having. I called you a couple of days ago.
Yeah.
As a result, they passed me on to my senator's office, Johnny Isaacson,
right.
And they are opening up a congressional inquiry about my husband's delay in pay
and
what's going on with the bank.
That is great.
I wanted to thank you for that. I also am very excited about President Obama's speech. You and I don't agree on the drone strike issue, and I love that we live in a country where that's completely okay. You know, we don't.
So you're okay with drone strikes?
I am in the way that President Obama described it. Al-Awlaki, as far as I'm concerned, President Obama said it perfectly in his speech. He doesn't have the shield of being an American citizen when he is plotting acts of terror against the country. He said he has no more of a shield than a sniper shooting a crowd of people when, you know, when the SWAT team goes and takes that sniper out.
Yeah.
And so it, to me, it's the same thing.
Except that we had, except that we had months to plan it. And it seems to me that there should have been some due process. Have a trial.
Well, he also explained that when you are, you know, when there are criminals, be them American criminals in countries that don't have the will to go and get him, and it could cause more harm and more loss of life, then you've got to make a choice.
Yeah, no, I get that. But, you know, again, they're not coming after Canada. What is it that we're doing that Canada's not doing, or vice versa, that maybe we should be thinking about? And that's where I thought his speech was brilliant when he talked about foreign aid. 1 month in Iraq, we could have funded a year's worth of schools in Pakistan.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. 5 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Mike Papantonio on the line with us. He is the attorney and host of Ring of Fire Radio, ringoffireradio.com, as the website. Hey, Pap, welcome back.
How are you, Tom?
Just great. How are you?
Good, thank you.
Good. Boy, a lot going on. The president just gave a barn burner of a speech. There were some really good pieces to it, but it was a speech. I don't see a legislative proposal attached to it. Do you want to share your thoughts on, did you catch the speech?
I just have reviewed it. I was doing a show while it was going on, but you know, what I've reviewed is this, there's really no surprises here. You know, Obama's a great speaker, but we always ask ourselves what happens after the speech. What I like to do is I like to analyze the validity of what somebody says according to its parts. And let's just take one part, for example. He's out front talking about the need to have a new shield law for the press.
Right.
That's his big talking point today because they were caught, they're caught red-handed doing things that offended anybody with the brain when they're spying on news journalists. So he comes out because he has to. He's very reactionary in that regard, Tom. He reacts according to what public opinion is.
But isn't that what you want?
Well, to some degree you want. No, the answer is not really. I want somebody who stands for something that I agree with, and he always stands for it.
Wouldn't have done it in the first place.
Yeah, exactly. So here we have a senator. As a senator, Obama actually helped draft the shield law. A lot of people don't know this. He actually helped draft the first journalism shield law. And then it was drafted, and it made it past committee, okay? Now, he's elected during the time that it makes it past committee, and when he becomes president, he actually does everything he can to interfere with that becoming law. And so I listened to him today, and I said, okay, so day one, yeah, I like it. Day two, I'm president. Day three, I'm criticized for abusing my power as president. Day four, I like it again. And so everything I listen to these days, Tom, I mean, I hate to sound so cynical, but I simply have to report what I've observed watching this character over these years. And so he's a wonderful speaker. I mean, he's wonderful. But if you look at the substance of what he delivers, it's a different story. I mean, just, you know, I could go on forever, but that's one example of that speech. And I'm going to digest it more. I'm going to look at it further. But the first thing is, what does the trend look like with Obama? Is there anything in the speech that he delivered today that is consistent with that trend?
Well, there was a whole series of left-handed swipes at George W. Bush. He said, you know, we went after al-Qaeda in Afghanistan, then we took our eye off the ball and went into Iraq. And that cost us standing in the world. It cost us blood and treasure. et cetera, et cetera. He talked about foreign assistance, and he said, for what we spent in 1 month in Iraq, we could be training security forces in Libya, maintaining peace agreements between Israel and its neighbors, feeding the hungry in Yemen, building schools in Pakistan, and creating reservoirs of goodwill that marginalize extremists.
Yeah, these are the same speeches he gave on the stump when he ran the first time. Yeah. I mean, so what I'm saying is, don't we have to be honest with ourselves about, you know, you ask me, well, what's my impression? And my impression is based on my following his history and understanding his history, I think, very well. And then saying, well, let me analyze, does what he's saying, does it match with what he's doing? And I just, at this point, I haven't overanalyzed the speech. I've analyzed the one part, and I know that part of the history. And I look at it and I say, well, you know, that should tell me more about the validity of the rest of the things he said. It's like having somebody on the witness stand, and when you catch him in that, that story that's not quite true, you ask the next question. So that's what.
Well, there's no doubting that this man is a politician.
Well, yeah, I mean that's putting it nicely.
But
Tom.
It is. I don't think that I would have heard this speech from Mitt Romney. And
you wouldn't have. Yeah. You would not have. We'd be at war with North Korea with
and Iran
and Iran
and so, probably Russia.
So I'm a realist. Right. Look, we had to vote for this guy, but then that's a different issue from saying, what do you think now?
Yeah,
you
no, said. I
it's
agree.
A totally different
agree.
Analysis.
And in fact, you know, let's when you've had an opportunity to look at the rest of the speech, I'd like to continue the conversation with you. In the meantime, let's talk about this IRS so-called scandal that I think in part. President Obama came out and gave this, you know, really big, major foreign policy speech today and called again for closing Guantanamo and all this other stuff to push off the headlines. You know, that's going to be the cynical response on Fox tonight.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, there's probably a lot of truth to it. But nonetheless, the IRS scandal, in quotes, it seems to me that the scandal is that these Tea Party groups are getting 501c4 status. And now with all the sturm and drang and screaming and howling and hollering, they're going to get it even more easily.
Mm. Well, you didn't have to have a press conference to take the attention away from the scandal. What you had to do is you had to come out and you had to say the IRS was doing exactly what we've asked them to do, and that is to protect taxpayers' money. After Citizens United, you had the billionaire inheritance babies that all had the plan to have these 501c4 organizations falling out of the sky like slimy tree frogs. And that's what happened. They're inundated with these applications. Yeah, so they're inundated with these applications, and they say, listen, all we're asking you, you're saying you want this. You're not given a right to have this. You have to prove that you're entitled to do that, to have this 501c4.
To have the rest of us pay for their share of the commons.
Because we pay for your right to go out and hold up a sign depicting Obama as a monkey or a Hitler at the same time you're telling us that you're a social welfare organization.
Right.
So the IRS was doing exactly what they were supposed to do, but you have these whiny babies who always miss the Democrats always miss the discussion and allow these whiny babies to create the narrative. And you had the Democrats say, oh my God, this is terrible. What have they done? This is awful. Well, no, it wasn't awful. Out of 300 of the organizations, I think fewer than 70 were even related to Tea Party organizations. We knew the history, didn't we? We knew that Karl Rove had come in with GPS Crossroads. We knew that he had lied about it being a social welfare organization, and most of the money was going to political organizations. We knew that the American Action Network, this is a great example, the American Action Network, you might remember, said, we're a 501c4, we want that special protection, we're a social welfare program, but in fact, 80% of their money went to political organizations, and the IRS did nothing about it. So now they say, we need to do something about it, and rather than, we have these weak chin, sniveling, Harry Reid types running the Democratic Party, and rather than speaking up and saying, damn it, there's nothing wrong with what the IRS did. In fact, if we catch them doing it again, we're going to throw them in jail. As a prosecutor, an ex-prosecutor, Tom, I got to promise you this. As an ex-prosecutor, I would love to have gotten one of those applications where the Tea Party signs off and says, yeah, this new Tea Party 501c4 organization is devoted to social welfare, and they have to plead that that's true. They have to affirm that it's true under prosecution of law. So they didn't want to have to do all that. They didn't want to have to fill out papers. And when the IRS started asking tough questions of them, they start whining like, you know, like school children, like little babies in Oshkosh diapers, for God's sakes. And the Democrats, rather than addressing that and fighting back, they cave in. It's just the nature of the Democrat. It all flows from the top. And right now the top is Harry Reid.
Now, this was not the nature of the Democratic Party in the 40s and in the 30s.
Not at all.
And
not
so
at all.
How do we get that Democratic Party back?
Well, you just got to have more Wydens out there. You've got to have more people that'll jump in and defend themselves rather than trying to react. You need to have some Ted Kennedys who on an issue like this would have gone in front of a camera and said, you know what? The IRS was doing exactly what they were supposed to do and defended the IRS rather than caving in.
Yeah, there you go. Mike Papantonio, ringoffireradio.com, the website, the host of Ring of Fire and attorney. Pap, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Tom.
It's always good talking with you, getting your perspective. We'll be back at 15 minutes past the hour. Stick around.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And be sure to check out Pap's website at ringoffireradio.com. We'll be back. Twenty minutes past the hour, fair and only slightly unbalanced. Tom Hartman here with you. Well, the president, I think this was a, if he follows through, and I believe he will, actually, not quite as cynical as my friend and colleague, although we'll see. I mean, you know, time will tell. But these partnerships, he says, can only work when we recognize the Muslims are a fundamental part of the American family. Indeed, the success of American Muslims and our determination to guard against any encroachments on their civil liberties is the ultimate rebuke to those who say we are at war with Islam. This is not the kind of rhetoric that you would have heard from John McCain, from President McCain. It's not the kind of rhetoric you would have heard from President Romney. And but, you know, that's not enough. Obviously, we've got to take it the next step and actually say, OK, let's do something about this. Well, actually, I think, you know, no longer, you know, spouting the neocon line about, you know, there's war everywhere. The entire world is a battlefield. And instead saying, no, it's time to end the war. I think that's a big deal. I genuinely do. You got a clip there, Shana? Here's the president's comments on the press.
But a free press is also essential for our democracy. That's who we are. And I'm troubled by the possibility that leak investigations may chill the investigative journalism that holds government accountable.
Anyway, 21 minutes past the hour. And let's get some thoughts in here. Mark in Ocala, Florida. Hey, Mark, you're a former Marine?
Tom, you found me, huh, brother?
Say what?
I said you found me. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for calling. What's up?
Actually, Tom, we're fellow Midwesterners, and I appreciate you hanging in there. I know you've had some issues, and I'm glad that you're staying strong. On a personal note, I do appreciate it.
Thank you.
I'm a United States Marine Corps veteran, and I voted for President Carter, and I served under President Carter, and a lot of civilians, unfortunately, don't realize that your president is only your commander-in-chief if you're in a uniform for the United States Armed Forces, but that's another issue.
Right.
Just wanted to comment on the president's speech and some of your observations. I would say with you, say to you, Tom, that I agree with your interpretations about the Constitution and trying people as a criminal enterprise. And I'm not calling to disagree in any aspect. I'm a former law enforcement officer. I worked down in Miami, Tom, back in the early 80s. So I took my Midwest values like your own and I put them to test to see if, you know, if it would change me with my views or to become hateful or, and I was there right as the Mariel refugees had gotten there, Tom, and I had learned to speak Spanish under President Carter with the U.S. State Department. And I was very, very well trained with the pistol. I trained as a Marine and then I trained at Marine Security Guard School and then we shot for 3 years straight. And then I fired distinguished experts. And I was in some life and death circumstances, Tom, where I could have actually justifiably shot people and chose not to. The analogy I'm trying to make is when you are somebody in charge of the health and welfare of a nation as large as ours, there becomes, as you would know, what are called exigent circumstances. So I think what the president alluded to just on the one point was that when they don't have the wherewithal, we don't have our own Americans that are able to get to people, nor do our local allies have the ability to get to them, then there may only be a solution where time becomes of an issue. Now, the thing that concerns me is about that would be that was an argument that was used for waterboarding, which I was totally and continue to be in disagreement with. I think that's unrealistic and not only illegal, but not even real.
Yeah,
but
you don't give up your values to, particularly when the technique is actually counterproductive. You don't give up your values to try to win a war in the name of your values.
Right, and I think that's what you were just saying a moment ago, Tom, and the president's also saying from different perspectives, trying to get to the same plateau, is if we really believe in ourselves as a nation. I think the last political people ran on a series of fear, and I think if people like us, Tom and Papantonio to be included, but I mean most democratic liberal people actually believe in who we are, and that's the thing that brings me to my second point, is when we as American citizens reach out to folks that are trying to become citizens, what I share with your call screener is no revelation made by myself, but it's an intuition that kicked in the second I heard it, is that there's a security expert that's just been featured here in the last day or two, who I think is a former lieutenant colonel in the Army, is saying that they think this is a tactic that has been shifted, where people are claiming citizenship and receiving citizenship as a weapon of war. And if you look even at what just occurred in England, these low-level attacks, again, are done by...
Yeah, I think what happened in England was you had a couple of crazies who were, Mark, thanks for the call, a couple of crazies who were claiming Islam. Terrorism is not Islam. Terrorism is not Christianity. Tim McVeigh or, the guy who shot the Holocaust Museum guard, they don't represent Christianity. And these guys, these so-called terrorists, they don't represent Islam. Rick in Alberta, Canada. Hey, Rick. Quick thought,
hello.
Please. We have just a minute.
Hi,
to
Tom.
Break.
Yeah. Hey, Tom. I think you mentioned as well just the contrast between the president and his speech and what it might have been with a John McCain presidency.
Right.
And we, in Canada, we have a sort of a parallel almost reversed, where we were lucky enough to have Prime Minister Chrétien in power when the Iraq War started, and he kept us out of there.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a lame duck Prime Minister, and so he could afford to make that call. And right now we have Prime Minister Harper, our own little neocon, and he, I wouldn't like to see how he'd behave.
Yeah. Yeah, there you go. Rick, thank you for the call. Yeah, Canada's going through some changes right now. 27 minutes past the hour. Very interesting. The president has given a pivotal, in my opinion, a pivotal speech. We'll see whether the nation pivots with him.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And are you pivoting with him, or do you think that this was just happy talk? Right after this. So, Medea Benjamin of Code Pink taking on the president. And, Medea just wrote a book about drone wars. And, in fact, we interviewed her last Friday as Conversations with Great Minds. During the next break, I'll put that up at conversationswithgreatminds.com. I don't think I've put it up there yet, but maybe we did. I don't know. I'd have to check. But we'll get that up. And but she didn't stop, and which is her, her want. I mean, this is what Medea and Code Pink do, and I salute nonviolent resistance. I salute people who speak back to power. And what I thought was amazing is that typically when Medea and her associates roll out their banners or start shouting, they get immediately hauled off. And instead, the president let her have her say somewhat, And then he kept talking, and it was like then 5-10 minutes later, she started interrupting him again. She was obviously still sitting there. So he was essentially, by saying to her, thank you, ma'am, and I'll answer that, and engaging her, was essentially saying to the Secret Service people in the room, you know, don't haul this person off. And I thought that was pretty impressive. I actually have it here on my computer, right queued to right where I want to start, if I may, if you can play it off my computer. This is President Obama. He's talking about, and the important thing here, I think, is not so much the interruption, but the fact that he's calling for closing Gitmo and what he has to say about that. So listen to this. This is the President of the United States this morning. There's the interruption, and I thought that was, you know, a class act the way he handled that. But then what he had to say afterwards is pretty important, particularly when he says it's only, you know, only politics justifies Congress, and that's not even arguably a justification. But here he is.
Our courts have convicted hundreds of people for terrorism or terrorism-related offenses, including some folks who are more dangerous than most Gitmo detainees. They're in our prisons. And given my administration's relentless pursuit of al-Qaeda's leadership, there is no justification beyond politics for Congress to prevent us from closing a facility that it should have never been opened.
Now, here,
today,
he gets an ovation for saying Guantanamo never should have even been opened. He's getting an ovation from the National Defense University. And then the DS speaks up.
So, let me finish, man. So today, once again, today, I'm about to address it, ma'am, but you got to let me speak. I'm about to address it. Let me address it. Why don't you let me address it, ma'am? Why don't you sit down and I will tell you exactly what I'm going to do.
That includes 57 Yemenis.
Thank you, ma'am.
It includes Shaker Amr.
Thank you. Thank you. Ma'am, thank you. You should let me finish my sentence. Today, I once again call on Congress to lift the restrictions on detainee transfers from Gitmo. I have asked the Department of Defense to designate a site in the United States where we can hold military commissions. I'm appointing a new senior envoy at the State Department and Defense Department, whose sole responsibility will be to achieve the transfer of detainees to third countries. I am lifting the moratorium on detainee transfers to Yemen so we can review them on a case-by-case basis. To the greatest extent possible, we will transfer detainees who have been cleared to go to other countries. Where appropriate, we will bring terrorists to justice in our courts and our military justice system. And we will insist that judicial review be available for every detainee. Now, ma'am, let me finish. Let me finish, ma'am. This is part of free speech, is you being able to speak, but also you listening and me being able to speak. All right? Thank you.
Interesting.
Told him, the way we treat you is the measure of our own liberty.
This is the second interruption, so I'll just stop at that point, but because we've already played that. This is a very, very interesting. There are some very interesting pieces to this speech, and I'm concerned that they might get lost in the Sturm und Drang around it and in the debate about what has preceded it. I did not see Lyndon Johnson repudiate the war in Vietnam. I was alive during that time. Lyndon Johnson never came out and said, it's time to end the war in Vietnam. It was a mistake. The authorization for that war, the Gulf of Tonkin Resolution, should be repealed. I will not sign any legislation that expands it. In fact, I want to see it ended. That's what President Obama said today about the authorization to use force that was given to George Bush after 9/11. He said, it's time to end this war. LBJ never said that. To the best of my knowledge, I mean, it's possible he said something like that, but I don't think so. Hubert Humphrey talked about, you know, ending the war, but it was always in the context of we've got to end the war, we got to win the war. And Richard Nixon, a secret plan to end the war with dignity. This would be a great time. I wish I had the clip of Jack Kennedy's speech on peace. I'm going to have to track that thing down and put it on this computer in here so I can play it, because I can see where the pieces are that I want to play. But anyway, we'll do that another time. Bob in Jamaica, New York. You wanted to talk about Anwar al-Awlaki's teenage son.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Hello?
Yeah, you're on the air.
Hi. You know, this president's actions regarding trade agreements, Wall Street and the banks, his foreign policy, and his treatment of whistleblowers can only make you cynical. What was the excuse for his killing of a 16-year-old American citizen, a 17-year-old American citizen?
I don't think he has an excuse, Bob. I haven't heard him give an excuse, and I think it's totally unjustified. I think it's a war crime. But that said, so you're a cynic. What are you going to do about it?
About what?
About your cynicism. You're unhappy with the president. What are you going to do about it?
I think if you look at one of the reasons why.
No, what are you going to do about it?
Stop firing these predator drones.
Okay, so what are you going to do about it?
About what?
About the fact that you don't like President Obama's presidency. What are you going to do about it?
But regarding his war act, his terrorism.
No, what are you going to do about it?
For me? What?
What are you going to do about it?
Call my congressperson.
Well, you really think that that's going to do it?
What do you mean, what am I going to do about it?
That's my point. My point is that if we're going to complain about something, we should have some action that we are going to take, or some plan. There needs to be more than just sitting around going, oh, he's not good enough for me.
That's not the point of it's not the point of not being good enough for him. It's that we must put more pressure on him and not let him get away with what he's getting.
Absolutely.
Okay, but what we're not doing is, first of all, if you really want to deal with this so-called terrorism, you got to be honest with yourselves and look upon what you're doing to create this terrorism.
Yes.
Fareed Shahzad is a good example of that. The guy who put that car up, luckily he was incompetent, who put it up in Times Square.
Yeah.
He put that thing up there as a direct result of Obama's use of predator drones in Pakistan, because he was a Pakistanian national.
I know.
A big part?
I said, I know. Okay. And that's why I think when Obama comes out and says, with the money that we spent in 1 month in Iraq, we could have been building schools across Pakistan and running them and Afghanistan. And let me find the exact quote. We could have been training security forces in Libya, maintaining peace agreements between Israel and its neighbors, feeding the hungry in Yemen, building schools in Pakistan, and creating reservoirs of goodwill that marginalize extremists. That is a change in direction from the way that this country was going under George W. Bush. It's not, you know, we haven't seen the change anywhere near as fast as you or I would like it. You know, both of us probably expected that 5 years ago when Obama came into office, everything was going to become wonderful. It didn't. But we have to, I think that, you know, my answer to what I'm going to do is, I'm going to send another $100 to Progressive Democrats of America. And Tim Carpenter's organization. And I'm going to show up in Los Angeles on June 1st, I think it is, on whatever that Saturday is, for a fundraiser with Lily Tomlin for this organization, which is not part of the Democratic Party, but is pushing the Democratic Party in a progressive direction. Because I think that it's not enough to just complain about this. We have to do something. We have to create movement politics. Bob, thank you for the call. And I don't disagree with you that I've said it. I'm getting redundant here. 45 minutes past the hour. We'll do it.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
45 minutes past the hour. We'll be right back. Let's check in with Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service and find out what's going on in the world. This Talk Radio News Service, TalkRadioNews.com report brought to you by GoatsForTheOldGoat.com, where you can give a crystal heart made by women recovering from the effects of the war in South Sudan. It goes to the old goat, GoatsForTheOldGoat.com. Hey, Ellen.
Well, thank you so much, and I know you've been talking all about the president's speech, so I'm not sure you want me to review it.
Well, I would love you to. I've been talking for 2 hours or an hour and a half, and almost 2 hours.
My view is, let me just give my overall view,
sure.
Tom, which is that I think that there are people like you and me, and even much more mainstream Democratic types, that were pressuring them so much on the issue of Guantanamo, on the issue of drones, that he was losing his base.
Yeah.
And I really consider this a base speech.
Yeah, I think so, too. And I think that this is an example of what happens when people push the president and you know, that he has come out and said these things and taken these positions. I mean, he's even saying it's time to end the war. He doesn't want he wants the authorization for military force that was given to George Bush to be put to an end. I mean, these are pretty substantial things.
Very much substantial things. And I also liked the way he responded to the protester from Code Pink. And he said, a citizen shouting her concerns at the president.
Yes, he said, we need to listen to that woman. Or that woman had something important to say, or words to that effect. Yeah.
I think that, so he talked about, obviously, he talked about the drones. That was a huge issue. And they had a call with reporters beforehand talking about several issues. And so I think that, you know, they are really, they're trying their best to reach out.
Here's the question, though. Are they going to be successful in doing anything?
Well, I think they will get the people from Guantanamo to Yemen. I don't see how it's possible sort of not to in that way. Let me just sort of run through the call today.
Sure.
They said, in the instances where U.S. citizens were targeted with the drones, there were careful reviews. They said the use of force alone cannot defeat violent extremism. They said they want to lift the moratorium to detainees to Yemen. The president has apparently been working on this speech since State of the Union. They say that the war on terror is an amorphous term. That Obama does not want to call it the war on terror anymore. He's going to define it more narrowly, and they are going to try and to dismantle networks that pose a threat to the United States. But he said you can't eliminate terrorism. The notion, I mean, this is his people speaking for him. The notion is that you can is not realistic. The president is not, because this is going to be a call from the right, that the president is seeking to expand presidential authority. He is not trying to do that. Obama said he believes that leakers should be the target of a Department of Justice investigation, not reporters.
So is he going to change?
The president also is going to do what he can to close Gitmo.
Right. So is he going to change this policy of going after James Rosen and the AP? I mean,
say they will. But of course, we don't have specifics on it.
Yeah. Okay.
He did say in the speech that he supports media shields. And the administration is reviewing guidelines.
Yeah.
I want to say this, and just sort of underline this, because he said there's a weakened al-Qaeda. He didn't say they got rid of them.
Mm-hmm.
And he said they are capable, however, of mounting smaller scale attacks.
Yeah, when he said, we haven't had a major attack, I was just like, oh, be careful.
Right. Okay, some other things going on. There is that bill to combat military sexual assaults. Today there was a joint conference by two Democrats, two Republicans, two of them senators, two of them House members, Nikki Tsongas, and Claire McCaskill on the Democratic side, Susan Collins, and Michael Turner from the great state of Ohio on the Republican side. It's called the Be Safe Act. They said that victims are re-victimized by the way the military is handling this. And they want to, as they had said earlier in the week, criminalize perpetrators outside of the commander's jurisdiction. In other words, it would be held by the JAG Corps.
Hmm. Interesting.
Speaker Boehner today, our favorite person, he said...
the orange man.
Yeah, that lawmakers are not to be rushed into passing an immigration bill. He said, we're just not going to take up and accept the Senate immigration bill. He said the House will have a solid immigration plan, and there is certainly some questions as to even if people who are have been illegal and then become legal, whether they can have access to our health care plan. I think if you become legal, you should be able to access what everybody else who's legal should do.
Indeed. Indeed.
But I guess they don't feel that way.
Yeah.
Okay, the federal fusion centers, these are in 77 cities. They were begun to share information. Well, today the ACLU talked about these powerful intelligence data hubs, and they said that they are gathering so much data that they're losing their way in terms of trying to find actual terrorists.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, the ACLU said that during the Tsarnoff situation and the Marathon bombing, that the FBI was chasing around protesters and not really honing in on who these people may be. Even the Heritage Foundation today said that the government should be much more focused.
Hmm.
So I think that, you know, it's interesting because we had the FBI, and they clearly yesterday when they, or 2 days ago when this guy was shot in Orlando, I mean, you have to think about it, Tom, you and I are not criminologists, but are we stupid enough to come and interview somebody that we are think murdered somebody, murdered not one, but three people, and murdered them perhaps just using, you know, all kinds of mixed martial art techniques, and they interview the guy in the kitchen?
Yeah, that doesn't make sense. In fact, this whole thing the whole thing has seemed fishy to me for a while, although I don't want to start sounding like Alex Jones, so I'll leave it at that. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Thank you, Ellen.
Thank you.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. 5 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Broadcasting on commercial radio stations from coast to coast on Sirius XM all across the North American continent, on Pacifica stations across America, Europe, and Africa, on American Forces Radio, and every U.S. military base in the world, and simulcast as television on both Dish Network, DirecTV, and cable systems nationwide via the Free Speech TV Network. Welcome back. Zach Beauchamp is with us. He's a reporter and blogger with Think Progress and editor of TP Ideas, thinkprogress.org, the website. Zach, am I pronouncing your name right?
Yeah, you got it. Very cool. Few people do, so well done.
Okay, thank you. You wrote this extraordinary piece, the inside story of the Harvard dissertation that became too racist for Heritage, the story of this fellow who had co-authored, I guess, the Heritage Foundation's piece, hit piece on the immigration bill, and one of his premises was that people of brown skin and Hispanic descent will never generationally catch up with white people because that's the way they're born. And you took this apart brilliantly. Can you tell us, first of all, tell us a little bit about this guy and how he got to Heritage and what the story was on this?
Sure. So the background is that this guy, Jason Richwine, he got his PhD from Harvard in 2009, which he did concomitantly at the American Enterprise Institute, which is the other big conservative think tank in D.C. So he was at the American Enterprise Institute, and then once his fellowship there ended, he moved over to Heritage to do math, basically essentially a quantitative job. Mm. And that job led him to co-author their report, which has been widely debunked since, on the costs of the comprehensive immigration bill that are currently in the Senate right now. So a researcher at the Washington Post, a blogger named Dylan Matthews, dug up his old dissertation from Harvard, and it turns out the dissertation posited that Hispanics will always, for the foreseeable future, have a lower IQ than what he terms native whites. It's unclear. Those terms are very poorly defined.
Right.
In the dissertation. And we can get into that later. But the point is, this became a huge controversy because the policy suggestions in Richwine's dissertation are very similar to the policy suggestions in the Heritage report. So Heritage, who wanted Congress to have to cite a report, couldn't deal with the taint of racism and had to dismiss Richwine, which led to the question I consulted in my piece, which is, if it's the case that this report is really so bad that Heritage and Richwine had to part ways in order for the report to be untainted, then how on earth did it make it through Harvard?
Right. And also, I mean, Pat Buchanan came out the other day and said yes, and threw some statistics out about, I believe it was college graduation or enrollment rates among Asians, whites, Hispanics, African Americans, and that seemed to support, I mean, he came out in support of Richwine. And there is this, you know, racist bunch that are laying out these arguments that were made back in the 1920s to justify what's the word that we had for the racial purity laws and
eugenics.
Eugenics, thank you very much. For eugenics, which were, you know, our posters actually were quoted and picked up by Hitler in his eugenics program, and which ultimately became his genocide program. And how does one rebut these?
So the basic fact of the matter is that whenever you talk to the people that will make this argument, they'll claim to be disinterested scholars. They're just doing research. And if you try to press them on their research, they'll say, look, this math is too difficult for you. You don't understand the discipline of psychometrics, as they refer to it. The real truth of the matter is that it's not very complicated to understand. There's a lot of academic, there's a bunch of math surrounding these things, but you don't need to be an expert in math to see the conceptual flaws and to evaluate the other readers that's in this field. Essentially, what you need to know is that they make arguments about essentially the genetic component of intelligence, which aren't supported by racial categories because it's hard to make racial categories into genetic categories in the first place. It's also the case that a lot of subsequent research has shown that any gap, and there is a gap in IQ scores between what we generally identify as people being of different races, is usually attributable in most cases as a group phenomenon to extreme poverty. That is to say, when people, and this should be surprising to nobody, but when people are raised in deprivation, exposed to pollution and high stress environments when they're kids, it hurts their brain development. As a consequence, they're likely to be less intelligent as they grow up. That's not surprising, but the point is that's an argument for extreme and very serious redistribution of wealth and addressing the consequences of poverty. It's not evidence that anyone is genetically less smart than anyone else or that racial categories are even meaningful. It's just that some people are poorer than others and poverty is bad.
Right, and poverty and exposure to lead and lead paint and I mean, all you do is just a whole, and even the stress of poverty associated with poverty jacks up cortisol levels in pregnant women, which changes the fetal brain development. I mean, Joseph Chilton Pierce wrote an entire book about that back 15, 20 years ago. This is, you know, well-established science. Really what we're looking at and what Pat Buchanan seems to be celebrating is 400 years, arguably, maybe going on 500 years of white privilege on the North American continent, is it not?
Yeah, I mean, the way that this research works is the people, and a lot of them, I think Jason Richwine is one of these people, I think he really thinks that he's doing important and good science and that he really genuinely stresses that he doesn't believe that there's any moral cast to his work.
Right.
The problem is that it's very easy to make that argument when you're a white guy. And when you're a white guy, particularly a white guy from a dominant class in a country, that is to say what we now understood as white, particularly many South European people, the Irish and Jews, were in the 1920s, you know, in the eugenics movement you referenced earlier, mm-hmm. always taken to be less intelligent according to this very same line of research. But anyway, if you're from a privileged white male class today, it's very easy to overlook the implications of your research and say, look, I don't mean for it to say that one race is superior than the other. But the fact of the matter is that claims about the inherent racial inherent genetic superiority of one grouping of people referred to as a race historically have been deployed for particularly nefarious ends. That's not to say that we shouldn't do research on why the score gap exists. In fact, if we enforced a total taboo on research on the link between race and IQ, we wouldn't have been able to learn that it's likely an environmental, almost certainly entirely an environmental thing in the first place.
Right.
So it's a good place for very careful scholarship that isn't focusing and fixating on genetic explanations to the exclusion of current research about how IQ works and how genetics work and so on and so forth. The problem with a lot of this genetic research is that it's not very careful work, and as a consequence, it ends up bolstering, as you said earlier, the forces of white privilege,
yeah,
even if unconsciously and unintentionally.
And you'd think that just the sliding time window would be evident to anybody who pretends to be a scholar. I mean, there were literally books published in the 1860s and 1870s following the large Irish migration to the United States of poor Irish people about the genetic inferiority of the Irish. And, you know, what's wrong with the Irish and, you know, how they've, you know, they're, and then similarly, there were books published, certainly lots and lots of newspaper magazine articles, the Saturday Evening Post, I believe had one in the 1890s about the genetic inferiority of the Italians, because there was a large wave of Italian immigration in the United States. And basically what these were, quote, white people, right? But they were poor people, and so they weren't performing as well in school, and they were more involved with crime and organized crime because they were poor people, because they were being discriminated against. How can we not learn from the lessons of our own damn country? I don't mean a damn country. You know what I mean. Our own damn lessons. Excuse me.
I see what you're saying. It's historically we should understand how this research works.
Yes.
And the ways in which science can be complicit in morally problematic ways of thinking. I mean, look at the people who end up defending Rushwine over the course of time.
Yeah.
Right? Like, one of the most infamous ones is John Derbyshire, a former writer for National Review, who was fired for saying that people should avoid large groups of blacks because essentially they're scary and more prone to crime, among other very racist things that he wrote in this piece.
Yeah.
Right? Oftentimes, many of the most vociferous defenders of this line of research are people who are on the fringes or hardline anti-immigration forces at sites like D-Dare.
Yeah.
And that should tell you something about what this research is and who it supports.
I think it tells us everything about it. Zach Beecham, reporter and blogger over at Think Progress. Brilliant piece you wrote. You can read it today at thinkprogress.org. The inside story of the Harvard dissertation. Thank you, Zach.
Thank you for having me, Tom.
Great to have you with us. We'll be back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So, you know, when are we going to start pushing back on this stuff in a very loud and large and public way? Yeah. Okay, breaking news. The Deputy Attorney General, Sri Srinivasan, Solicitor General, thank you, was just unanimously confirmed to the First Circuit Court of Appeals. This is a guy who probably will be, if a seat opens up on the U.S. Supreme Court, he's probably going to be the guy that Obama's going to put there. And he's Indian-American, as in from India, and it's the D.C. Circuit. Oh, it's not the First Circuit. Okay. All right. But this is the D.C. Circuit Court. I thought that was the First Circuit. It's not. Oh, okay. So anyhow, it's the D.C. Circuit Court. And this is the court that has this horrible shortage. I mean, you know, there were four empty seats out of the 11 that are supposed to be there. There were only seven justices, and four of them were Republicans, three were Democrats. And this is the court that hears the cases that have to do with federal law. And so this is the court that has been issuing all these wackadoodle things about the EPA can't do this and the National Labor Relations Board can't do that. The president can't do the other thing. And a lot of it having to do with labor law, frankly. And the Republicans had been filibustering him up to this point. And Mitch McConnell decided to ease the filibuster. And Harry Reid said, oh, well, if you do that, then I won't do the nuclear option. There are still three empty seats. It's now a 4-4 balancing act. It's not a 4-3 majority, Republican majority anymore. But now it's a 4-4. Which means that the Republicans still have an enormous amount of power on that court. And in fact, to the point that Mitch McConnell has said that any attempt by the president to put anybody into those three empty seats will be met. Well, here's the actual. This is from Talking Points memo. But Senate Republicans who blocked Obama's prior nominee to the court, Caitlin Halligan, are telegraphing a mass filibuster of the remaining three vacancies. Senator Chuck Grassley, Republican from Iowa, recently unveiled legislation to reduce the number of active seats on the court from 11 to 8, arguing that it doesn't need more judges. He admitted to TPM he isn't expecting Democrats to support the legislation. They've dismissed it. So this is like, you know, it's good news, but it's like good news in the context of this bizarre news that any attempt by the president to make the judiciary more friendly to things like labor and the average person is being fought tooth and nail by the Republicans in the Senate, and that Harry Reid is not willing to blow up the, you know, to use the nuclear option to say no, at least with regard to nominees, to judiciary nominees, we're going to suspend the Senate rules. And we're going to say, you know, it's going to take an up or down vote. There's no more filibusters. Sorry. And the reason Harry Reid isn't willing to do this, he says, is because, well, you know, the Republicans may take the Senate in the next election, 2014. And if the Republicans take the Senate in 2014, we want to make sure that this rule is in place so they'll be constrained. Harry, if the Republicans take the Senate, the first thing they're going to do is end the rule. I mean, they're no idiots. They've made no blood oath. Mitch McConnell made a deal with you at the beginning of this year that he wasn't going to filibuster anything anymore. He lied. I mean, every 2 years he makes this deal and he lies. Mitch McConnell's a liar and a bully and a corporate thug. Anyway, Bob. In Marseille, how's that pronounced in Illinois there, Bob?
Well, nobody here speaks French, so it's Marseille.
Marseille's instead of Marseille. Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
That was my recollection. Listening on WCPT. Thanks, Bob. What's up?
Well, basically, I wanted to call to respond to the guy that you gave the what's he gonna do about it routine to, and that fits so well with your tag. You're it. And it's the problem with democracy, and we better learn to put up with it. Simply because when it turns us all into cynics, the solution is to make the system work, not to throw it away. You've got a choice. We could take the Politburo, and Stalin and Khrushchev managed not to, to press the button working things that way. And we had Eisenhower over here, and he managed not to press the button, even though he funded the military industrial complex to the point where they had silos dug in every wheat field in the plains and contaminated half of Washington. It may not be the best way to do it. But democracy is what we're working with, and we better make it work.
Yeah, we need to get involved. Bob, thank you. Well said. And you're basically paraphrasing, I think it was Winston Churchill, who said, democracy is a terrible form of government, but it's the best anybody's ever come up with. And so that's a good one. Barbara in Hollister, California, you got the March Against Monsanto nationwide this Saturday. You wanted to give us some information on it?
Yes, thanks for taking my call. It's a global day of protest. Happening across the world. You've heard about it,
mm-hmm.
Right?
Yes.
Right.
We've awesome. Talked about it on this program.
Right. Thanks. Thanks for doing that. Anyways, I just want to call in and let you know that I'm going on Saturday, and I would encourage any of your listeners to find an event near them on Saturday and show up.
Do you have a website off the top of your head?
Yes. There's marchagainstmonsanto.com.
Marchagainstmonsanto.com. That's easy enough to remember. Thank you very much, Barbara. And
awesome. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah, I appreciate it. And this, by the way, let us not forget, when the good citizens of California got enough signatures to put it on the ballot to say genetically modified foods, at the very least, we're not going to ban them. You can grow them. You can make food out of them. You just have to put it on the label that it's a genetically modified organism, a GMO. Monsanto came into the state and spent tens of millions of dollars to to convince the people of California that if they had to change the label, the price of food would just go through the roof. Well, wait a minute. They changed the labels to list the amount of salt, the price of food didn't go through the roof. They changed the label to list calories, the price of food didn't go through the roof. Monsanto lied, and now nobody knows who gets GMOs.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
So people are a little upset about this, and I guess marchagainstmonsanto.com is part of the response. Past the hour. Welcome back. Hey, it's Thursday. Let's get geeky. According to a new study, mosquitoes that carry the parasite that causes malaria may be more attracted to human body odor. The study published in the journal Plus One reports that compared with non-infected mosquitoes, those carrying the malaria-causing parasite Plasmodium falciparum were more likely to visit a fabric covered with a person's sweat more frequently. Malaria is one of the most prevalent diseases worldwide. Hundreds of millions of people have it. Nearly a half million people die from it every year. Plasmodium falciparum's ability to influence mosquitoes may help to explain why so many people become infected with malaria. And researchers have found that mosquitoes infected with the parasite feed longer on humans, increasing the likelihood that the parasite will be passed on and individuals will develop malaria. To study how the malaria-causing parasite affects mosquitoes' attraction to humans, a team of researchers in the Netherlands collected foot sweat from a volunteer who wore nylon stockings for 20 hours. The researchers then put the sweat-soaked stockings in a cage with two groups of mosquitoes, one infected with the Plasmodium parasite and the other that wasn't. Infected mosquitoes visited the sweaty stockings three times as much as their non-infected counterparts. And the research is remarkable, but researchers don't know how or why the parasite manipulates the mosquito's sense of smell, and it's still unclear which specific component of human odor is the most attractive to mosquitoes. But we do know one thing. Mosquitoes aren't the only members of the animal kingdom influenced by microorganisms. In research published earlier this year, it was revealed that the gut bacteria inside the intestines of human beings may be tied to our likelihood of gaining weight and becoming obese. This was a study published in the Journal of Clinical Endocrinology and Metabolism back in March. Researchers found that overweight people may be more likely to have a specific type of intestinal microbe present. The study involved 792 people who had their breath analyzed to help diagnose various digestive orders. They agreed to let researchers measure levels of hydrogen and methane in their breath. Elevated levels indicate the presence of a microbe called Methanobrevibacter smithii. It's a methane-producing bacteria that lives in the gut. The people with the highest readings in the breath test were more likely to be heavier and have more body fat, and the researchers suspected that the microbes may at least be partly responsible for their being overweight or obese. At the same time, there have been hundreds of studies that have shown that other forms of bacteria and other more microorganisms can be beneficial to us, you know, like acidophilus, you know. So what's the bottom line here? Now, first, we may be in the very early stages of learning how to combat one of this planet's most prevalent diseases, malaria. But more importantly, we're beginning to learn more and more about the roles that microorganisms play in our everyday lives. Just the statistics are pretty mind-boggling. 10% of the total weight of our body is non-human microorganisms. 90% of the DNA in our body is non-human microorganisms. Viruses and bacteria, principally, although there's molds and fungi and all kinds of things that are us. We are ambulatory microorganism machines. It's pretty amazing. So anyway, we've got the president's speech. We've got this wackadoodle racial stuff. We've got in the news, Srinivasan was just put on the District of Columbia Circuit Court. This is like good news. It's relatively speaking. Patricia in Denver, Colorado, listening on AM 760, Denver's progressive voice. Hey, Patricia, what's up?
Hi there, Tom. Sorry, I wanted to get off my speakerphone.
Sure.
I do IQ testing for a living, and so I was really intrigued by your conversation about Jason Richwein.
Mm-hmm.
In the Heritage Foundation study, and first of all, let me just say I'm appalled at what you're finding and what's being reported.
But I guess my thinking is, where did the data come from that was used in that study? You know, having done IQ testing for 25 years, thousands of IQ tests I've administered over the years. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you have to be specially trained to administer those. And a big part of our training is how to account for bias, cultural bias.
Right.
And we don't give a test in English to a Spanish-speaking child. It's just not done. We either give the universal nonverbal intelligence test, or we give the WISC-IV Spanish version, or we have an interpreter. So that data just sounds funny to me. And you know, I agree, eugenics is despicable, and IQ tests should never be used for that purpose. And obviously, because it's my profession, we're just so careful in psychometrics to control for that. And I do have to say, too, that in my personal experience, IQ testing has actually benefited many immigrant children. I've done IQ testing for immigration cases where children weren't able to get services in Mexico mm-hmm. that they needed, and they were able to get them here in the United States. And
Is this really for gifted kids or learning disabled kids or both?
Learning disabled, developmentally mm-hmm. delayed. In mm-hmm. some cases, children had parasitic brain issues, and you know, we had to do measures of cognition in order to determine their need.
Sure. So these were like failure to thrive problems.
In some cases, yes. Yeah. And then here's a really interesting case. I had a boy in a school who was in a classroom for children with severe, profound developmental delays, and I was just doing a review of his services and was doing the IQ test, and I gave him the universal nonverbal intelligence test, and he turned out to have a gifted IQ.
Wow. So was he autistic?
Of over 130. No. Huh. He was very bright. He was bilingual. And his parents were monolingual Spanish. And he had come from California, where IQ testing is against the law. And so nobody had ever measured his IQ, but he did. You know, he functioned. He couldn't function in the regular English-speaking classroom very well. And they used the records from California and put him in this classroom. And, yeah.
Wow. Amazing. Amazing. Patricia, thanks for sharing your story with us.
Well, you're so welcome, and thank you for reporting the story. And
yeah, I think it's important that we push back against these crazies, and God forbid we ever get on another eugenics jag in this country. I mean, it caused so much death and destruction. Patricia, thank you. David, in Minneapolis, Minnesota, listening on AM 950, Minnesota's Progressive
Voice.
Thank you. What's up, David?
Taking the call. Just one quick comment. I think the quote you were looking for by Winston Churchill
mm-hmm.
was, "Democracy is the worst form of government, except for all the others."
Perfect. Thank you, David, for correcting my recollection. That's marvelous. Thank you very much. Herman in Sacramento, California. Hey, Herman, what's up? Thanks for watching Free Speech TV.
Yeah, how you doing, Tom?
Fine.
I think that we've been a little bit critical of Obama. You know, his powers are limited by the Constitution. The executive office can only do so much. Obama, I think he's been the first president that's been elected with such a hostile Congress.
Since Harry Truman.
Their whole purpose was to make him a failure from the very beginning, and they've tried that.
Yeah.
In order for this man to get anything done, he had to use methods that probably never been tried before. You got like Mike Papantino and some of the others. I've heard Mike before. But each time he appears to be very critical of the president about what he's doing or what he's not doing.
Well, Pap's not here. Let's not pick on anybody who's not here. But, you know, if you want to speak in the abstract, so basically what you're saying is you're a fan of the president and you're not cynical.
Right. Some of the others who I've heard, they've just been critical of the president. You know, when he was first elected, they had the problem of being a birther and the problem of being incompetent. And once he was elected, I heard sometime that he thought he was king and that he was going to...
These were the Fox News memes, yeah. Yeah, no, I'm with you, and it's... I think he's done actually quite a bit and a lot of good stuff. I've got a long list of things that I can argue with him about, but the fact of the matter is that politicians respond to public pressure. Thank you, Herman Hemman, for the call. And I think that Ellen Ratner, she was so spot on that this was the speech that Obama And these are the policies, the directions that he's going now with his administration in order to hang on to his base. And in other words, he hurt us. I think that's a good thing. That's how democracy is supposed to work. It's not that, hey, where's the benevolent, perfect king? Let him rule. No, that's not how it works. The way it works is we elect politicians and then we push them and push them and push them and push them and eventually they do the right thing. Because not doing the right thing is always a lot easier. And that's our job. Norma in Montgomery, Alabama. Norma, a minute to the break. It's yours. What's up?
Well, I just wanted to say something about the corporations and their greed. Most of them have taken their companies outside the United States, and then they expect us to buy their products when the people don't have a job.
Yep.
The people they left behind, they didn't take their brain with them. They need to go ahead and start their own companies and produce a product made in the USA, which I will buy. I'm not buying anything made overseas.
Well, good luck with that. I would take it a step further and say we need to get involved and active in the political process and change our insane trade policies and tax policies so that companies are not rewarded any longer by when they take jobs overseas and they are actually punished when they do that with trade sanctions, with tariffs, as we had from the George Washington administration to the Reagan administration. But 30 years of Reaganomics and free trade-onomics and GATT and NAFTA and SHAFTA and CAFTA and all this other stuff, it's ruining this country. And Norma, thank you for the call. And that is the political process. Make no mistake about it. And this is another thing that we should be pushing the president on. He's still enthralled with free trade. And I think we need to say, no, most people don't want free trade. Oh, Ross Perot, he was right.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And you know who else is right on this? Sherrod Brown and Raul Grijalva and Keith Ellison and Peter DeFazio, the Progressive Caucus. They're right on. 10 minutes before the hour, welcome back. Tom in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. You had a comment on our geeky science story. Hey, what's up?
Yes, hey, Tom. Long-time listener, long-time watcher. The mosquito issue. I kind of compare them to the Republican Party mosquitoes. I've been referring to the Republican Party as the Mosquito Party.
Right.
And I'm just trying to wonder why they seem to act alike, and whether this issue that they all seem to be going narcissistic sociopaths.
Well, not all of them, but there is Olympia Snow. It seems. So do you think that there's a microorganism that has infected the Republicans? Is this like Invasion of the Body Snatchers, only they're little tiny ones?
Well, I'm not going all supernatural on this stuff.
I would say that there actually is a cause effect thing, that one of the reasons why you see so many people in the Republican Party who are in love with money and power is that the Republic, there's this cycle. The Republican Party is saying, okay, we're the party of money and power. So what is it going to attract to it? It's going to attract people who want money and power. And there's a cycle there, just like the mosquito wanting to bite people and take their blood and in the process inject the malaria parasite into them. So, yeah, interesting analogy. Tom, thanks. Thanks a lot for the call. Eric in Salem, Illinois, listening on Sirius Satellite Radio. Hey, Eric, what's up?
Oh, nothing much, Tom. I want to thank you for everything that you do, and I love listening to your show every day while I'm driving around.
Thank you.
And my question was actually about Agenda 21. Now, I don't know exactly what it is. I had a right-winger friend of mine refer me to the propaganda book that Glenn Beck wrote, and yeah. I can't seem to find any actual information on what it really is.
So there was a UN conference, and we did a show on this once. I'm sorry, I don't remember. It was held outside the United States. It was in some country, and there were... And it was just, it was like one of these weekend meetings where they talk about a whole bunch of different things. And each one of the topics, each one of the breakout sessions were called agendas. And so there was Agenda 1, Agenda 2, Agenda 3, Agenda 4, Agenda 5. You know, one was on food, and one was on, you know, they had just a bunch of different topics. And Agenda 21, as I recall, do you recall the topic of it?
I'm not even really sure. I mean, I flipped through the book, but I didn't really find
it. Well, what it was they came up with a set of recommendations to accomplish something. And I frankly, you know, there have been so many of these things that have come and gone, I don't remember the details of it. But it was, you know, recommendations to make a better world. And whether it had to do with my recollections, it might have had something to do with food supply, although it's not inconceivable it had something to do with gun control or something. But whatever it was simply... it was a meeting that was held, like in Lima, Peru or something, where a bunch of people sat around and said, okay, what shall we recommend to the world? Okay, well, here's our recommendations. And, you know, the governments can take it or leave it. But this is our suggestion. And that's what Agenda 21 is. It's a set of non-binding suggestions that were developed during a panel session, or ultimately came out of a panel session in one of these UN meetings. So you can track down the real story on it. I mean, the right-wingers have tried to make this, this is the UN coming to fill in the blank, right? Take your guns, run your family, take away your children, whatever. The UN doesn't have that kind of power. I'm sorry, they don't. And, the only kind of power they have basically is to criticize us if we start bombing countries that, we said we wouldn't because we signed the UN Charter. So, Eric, thanks for the call. Joseph in Patton, Maine, watching Free Speech TV on Dish Network. Hey, Joseph.
Well, hello, Tom.
Hey, so you're going to tell me that there is tar sands oil in Maine? Really?
I'm going to tell you that there is talking in Portland now, and this is the fourth or fifth time they've done it,
mm-hmm.
that they're going to try to pump a diluted form of tar sands 236 miles through a 72-year-old Portland-Montreal pipeline.
Whoa. That doesn't sound good.
So we're all worried about out west, and they're going to sneak it in Portland.
So they're going to – how are they getting it to Montreal? By truck? By train?
I don't have the faintest idea, but that's all the information that we have in the newspapers and things like this. But
wow.
It was knocked down once, but they brought it back, and the council people keep saying that they can't get the clarity. They can't get their arms around what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
So I feel as though there's a little bit of wrongdoing here.
Yeah. Yeah, it doesn't sound good. Joseph, thanks for the heads up. I'll have to check into that. There's tar sands oil. There's the big running across Michigan, the big leak into the Kalamazoo River. Andy in San Pedro, California. Last minute of the show, Andy. It's yours.
Two comments. First, it's nice to see that now the EU is on board in investigating these transnationals for evading paying their fair share of taxes. And the EU estimates it to be about $1 trillion annually that they're losing.
Yeah. There's a good piece in the New York Times today. There's talk about among the banking industry in Europe that if they don't change their ways, they're going to be put out of business.
That would be wonderful. And then the second, I'd like to get your comment on this item that seems to be starting to catch a little legs in Congress, but still not with the main press media. What Lawrence O'Donnell of MSNBC has pointed out that the IRS in 59 changed one word in the 501.
Right. From must to majority, or what? You've got the words right. Exclusively to primarily. That was it. Andy, I gotta run. Thanks for the call. You're right. Lawrence did a great job of pointing that out. Tomorrow it's Friday. That means it's Brunch with Bernie. America's Senator Bernie Sanders will be here taking your calls on the important issues of the week. And anything goes Friday, we'll cover pretty much any topic that seems interesting. And don't forget, democracy begins with you. Yeah, you got to do something. Tag your it. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.